Okay, well, I'm really excited to be here. I come from Vassar College, which I think some of you know and some of you don't, so I like to start my talk sometimes with this picture. So Vassar College actually has a long history of astronomy, so it's a really neat place to be because Vassar, the very first faculty member hired at Vassar was Mariah Mitchell, who's a very famous, she's called kind of the first female professional American astronomer. So astronomy is kind of a big deal at Vassar. That is the old telescope. It's no longer used because it's situated in a terrible, like, low-lying spot on campus with lots of bad seeing and lights. So it's now moved. We have a modern, more modern observatory. But you can see that we have a lot of astronomy history at Vassar. And as we were just discussing, Vera Rubin was also an undergraduate at Vassar. A lot of astronomy at Vassar. It's really great. All right, so this talk I think is going to be a lot different from maybe the discussions I've seen so far, because what I want to do is I want to tell you, first of all, about molecular spectroscopy just in general, so you kind of get a sense of what's possible and maybe what's not possible with those types of observations. And then I'm going to tell you kind of an observational story or an observational mystery. And only at the end, I'm going to tell you a little bit about how that mystery could be solved by disk winds. And I'm not entirely convinced that that's the answer, but I thought of all the work that I do, that might be of most interest to this crowd. So I'm going to kind of present maybe in a different way than you might be used to from these last few weeks. So again, overview of molecular spectroscopy, and then tell you about this observationally based conundrum, which is essentially that we have some protoplanetary disks, a large fraction, definitely not the majority, but a large fraction of disks that are not well explained by our traditional disk models. And then I'll talk about one of the best possible explanations for these weird features, which is that we could be seeing disk winds. And I'll talk about the arguments for and against the idea that these are explained by disk winds. Okay, so this is my Astro 101 slide, just to make sure that we're all picturing the same thing when we talk about protoplanetary disks. So they are, in fact, disk-shaped, right? And they consist of both gas and dust. They are typically a few hundred astronomical units across, so certainly large enough to form planetary systems like our own. And we're talking about ages of a few million years. And most importantly for this talk, the distances of almost all protoplanetary disks that we study are greater than 100 parsecs. So the 100 AU size disk subtends only an arc second. So that makes spatially resolving disks challenging. And that's one of the benefits of using spectroscopy, because you use spectral resolution as a proxy for spatial information. If you consider the vertical structure of protoplanetary disks, it tells us something about what we're looking at when we view molecules. So in the very cartoony sense, the protoplanetary disks has three regimes in the vertical sense. So in the midplane, things are cold, so molecules freeze out. So we don't really see molecules in the gas phase in the midplane. At the very surface layers, we have a lot of UV, and so molecules are dissociated. So there's no molecules in the very upper atmosphere. And then there's an intermediate layer, which is molecule rich. And this is an actual model, so no longer a cartoon, of different molecular abundances versus height. And so you can see that at the midplane, very few molecules, then they sort of all shoot up in sort of an intermediate region, and then they go away at the highest heights. And here is an actual image of a protoplanetary disk seen edge on. And so we're seeing here the flared shape. It turns out that if you ask a priori whether you would expect to see molecules in emission in a protoplanetary disk, the answer is not clear. And the main reason is that the disks are dusty. And so here's my poor PowerPoint skills, just showing that you're basically obscuring your disk with dust. And what happens is that, at least at optical and near-infrared and mid-infrared wavelengths, the densities in the disk atmosphere are lower than the critical densities for many of the lines that you're looking at. So it's not obvious that you would see strong emission from molecules. So we kind of have to get lucky, and so we got lucky in many different ways. So first of all, there is dust settling and growth, and so that creates a higher gas to dust ratio in the atmosphere that lets us see molecules. There is gas heating, so the gas and dust can be decoupled, thermally decoupled. And there's also some non-thermal excitation of some of the molecular lines. So it actually has made it possible to see molecular emission. Excuse me. The other option you have is to go to millimeter wavelengths, and this is one of the reasons why ALMA is so exciting. So if you go to millimeter wavelengths, actually not at the shortest wavelengths of ALMA, but at the longer wavelengths, then most of the disk becomes optically thin. That's just because the grain opacity has dropped. For this talk, I'm going to focus primarily on infrared observations, and I'll kind of explain why in a minute. So in the infrared, we're still stuck with this issue of high optical depth. So I believe that the first molecular emission observed from protoplanetary disks, and certainly the most prominent kind of emission, was from CO fundamental lines. So here's our energy ladder. So CO fundamental is a rho vibrational line. So it's a transition that's both between vibrational states and between rotational states. And here's what it looks like. These are Keck-Nernst-Beck spectra. And what you're seeing here is each of the rotational transitions. And these are all the V equals 1 to 0 vibrational transition. And these are for different sources. And this was from Joe Nagita, who was here recently, I believe. I would say the other really exciting breakthrough in this field was the detection of lots and lots of molecules with the Spitzer infrared spectrograph. So that's what we're looking at here. So let me show you. This is actual data for a source called AS205, which is going to come up multiple times in this talk. And here's a model spectrum. What you're seeing is, so this sort of side to this feature here is carbon dioxide. One of these features here is OH. Not shown is HCN and acetylene, but everything else that you see in this spectrum is water vapor. So everything here is due to water. So these are incredibly water-rich spectra. And if you ask how common these features are, it turns out they're quite common. And that's really important, because if they're not common, then you could be selectively looking at certain types of disks. We'd really like this to be an almost universal phenomenon so that you can study disks in general. So this shows the detection fraction of different molecules versus spectral type. What you see is that, so the highest bar is basically CO fundamental emission, and that's seen from almost all disks. If you ask kind of which disks are missing that emission, it's things like transition disks, which have cleared regions, or various unusual disks. So I would say, in general, it's almost ubiquitous for all sort of classical T Tauri disks that are accreting. And then if you look at other molecules, well, there's a whole story here about why more massive stars don't seem to show any molecular emission besides CO, which I won't really get into today at all. But if you look at lower mass stars, then these have detection fractions of something like 40 to 50% for molecules besides CO. So again, these are very common things to see. So what can you actually do with molecular spectroscopy, and why is this interesting? Well, the main focus of my work so far has been probably chemistry. So obviously you can detect molecules, you can ask what molecules are there. You can do a little bit more than just ask what's there. You can figure out the temperature by looking at the relative abundances of different lines. You can ask how much is there by just counting the number of photons you're getting. So you can kind of construct a chemical map, if you will, of a protoplanetary disk. You can also do some more careful work about spatially locating molecules and This is just to give you a sense of what that looks like. Here is a disk model. So this is height, and this is radius, or distance from the star. And what this shows is these boxes are where the main contribution to a given line is from. So you can see, for example, if you look at a 63.3 micron water emission line, it's coming from the few AU region. If you look at this line out at 269 microns, it's coming from the outer disk. So again, you can kind of use the relative strength of different lines, especially something like water vapor, which has lines everywhere, and you can reconstruct the chemistry of your disk.
So what happens at that transition? At around
here?
Four,
yeah, so this is an unusual disk. It is actually a transition disk, and so it has a wall. And so at this wall, there's kind of a more direct emission, it directly sees the sunlight, so it puffs up. Yeah, and it's heated.
Can I just say this? Yeah. That slide there, so some of the stuff is quite near the mid-plane area, in the sense that you're not very high up, particularly the outer parts, and you've got what are effectively emission lines going on here. So I would have expected to see an emission line from a warmer part of the disk higher up. Is there a sense that most of the emission is really coming from a sort of heated layer rather than sort of towards
the mid-plane?
Yeah,
that's a good question. So if you asked, to think a little bit about what physically this region means or that region means, but you should also realize that these are actually borderline millimeter lines, right? So this, we're talking 200 microns now. So that's the sub-millimeter almost.
Optically thick or optically thin, the emission?
Is the emission optically thick? Good question. I think in general these lines are a combination of optically thick, so like optically thick from the inner part of the disk and then possibly optically thin and then, yeah, because you're not really looking at just a blob, you're looking at a sum of all of the little blobs around the disk, so it's actually a complicated answer, I think. Really good questions. Okay. So the more interesting aspect of this work, I think, for this group will be talking about studying disk motion or studying gas motion. So one thing you can do is spatially locate molecules using the Doppler shift and Kepler's third law. Here's my Astro 101 version of that. So you measure your wavelength, you convert to velocity, and then you infer a radius using Kepler's third law. And here's what it looks like with actual data. So here, this is actually a water vapor emission line that I observed from a protoplanetary disk. And then those are three models in which I have changed the inner extent of the emission. And what you see, of course, is that if you have emission very close to the star, it's moving very rapidly, so you get a wide line. And if you have emission far from the star, as in this very extreme case here, then you get a very narrow line shape. So that's the game we can play. The caveat with all of this kind of work is that the lines need to be spectrally resolved. We can do something even more precise in terms of spatial information, which is called spectroastrometry. Spectroastrometry is basically we put our slit on top of the disk, and then we ask what is the spatial position of the disk as a function of velocity. So here's my schematic for putting the slit on top of the disk. We have a blue side to the disk and a red side. So if we ask where is the disk when we look only at blue light, well, the disk is over here, so let's say offset in a negative direction from the center. And then we could ask where is the disk when we look at the red light, and it's off on this side. So the position is now over here. And so this is actual data. Measuring the spatial centroid as a function of velocity. And this is, with the exception of whatever weird thing is going on here, this is the expected profile for a Keplerianly rotating disk, so a typical Keplerian disk. As with other forms of astrometry, what you're doing is you're measuring the location of the centroid of your emission, And so your spatial accuracy is significantly better than the full width half max of the image. So same with regular astrometry. You know where the center of your star is much better than you know than just the full width half max of the star. So you can get really precise information with this technique. Again, it requires that the lines be spectrally resolved. And finally, if you want to dig even deeper, you can look beyond the Keplerian profile and say, are there deviations from Keplerian motion? That's basically what the rest of my talk is going to be about. So if you do see these deviations, what's causing them? And an important point about this is that if you'd like to study deviations, then you need to have enough spectral resolution that you can resolve the deviations. So if the deviations are 1/10 of the Keplerian velocity, then you need enough spectral resolution on your instrument to get down to 1/10 of the Keplerian velocity. And that's challenging, as I'll show you in a minute.
But that spectrum you should, that's an outflow, not...
This here?
Yes.
No, this is a spectro-astrometric profile. It is not a spectrum. It's the spatial centroid as a function of wavelength. I know, we're so used to seeing it's like P Cygni or whatever. It's not. This is spatial centroid as a function of velocity. So I'll walk you through it again. What's happening is we're saying, where is the disk when I only look at the blue light? The disk is over to the left. So in terms of my slit, which I've conveniently oriented along the major axis, it's to the left or negative.
Oh, so it's just a left or right. Okay, it would always be a double. Okay.
It's just right. The spatial centroid.
I've not come across a presentation like that.
Yeah, so basically, it's the reason this is not too popular is, well, it's tricky for many reasons, which I can get into if you're interested. But if you spatially resolve the disk, then you can do channel maps. So like with ALMA, you actually make channel maps where you go from blue to red and you get these beautiful images. This is the poor person's version of channel maps because we only get the dimension along the slit. So it's not the ideal way to do this. It's just, it gives you this really powerful information if you know how to interpret it. All right, so this is some of the facilities that I've used so far, just to give you a sense of what's possible. So what I've done here is taken a bunch of the instruments that are available for spectroscopy. So, and here we have the resolution of the spectrograph, and here is the wavelength that it observes at. And I've also done a couple other things, so I've converted resolution to the velocity that you can resolve. And then I've also done kind of a simplistic conversion of wavelength to distance from the star, just by assuming that the wavelength corresponds to the peak of a black body, and that the black bodies are at equilibrium temperatures. So that's certainly not true, but it gives you a sense that some facilities are probing regions that are close to the star, and others are probing regions far from the star. And this is clearly an overestimate for what ALMA is actually sensitive to. But it gives you a sense. So let me point out a few things. So again, ALMA has extremely high resolution. That's really, really exciting. But it is mostly sensitive to the outer disk. This is not, it's not true that it's only sensitive to 10,000 AU, but it is certainly not sensitive to 1 AU.
What does TW Hydra resolve down to 1 AU?
So the resolution of the continuum observation, so the absolute resolution is something like a few AU at the most extended. Also, TV Hydra is one of the closest disks, so that's the closest you're going to get in terms of AU. But when you're talking about line observations, it's different, because then you have to worry about whether you can actually detect the signal from the inner part of the disk.
I guess I'm saying that on that plot, it's not the resolution that's the issue for ALMA, it's the temperature
that's
setting it. But you're not necessarily, but with ALMA, you're sensitive enough to probe very far from the peak of the black body, which is why you can see the inner disks.
Yes, so it's not I wouldn't call it some sort of strict theoretical limit that you can't move beyond, but it becomes very, very challenging because it becomes a dynamic range issue. Okay. So this is why the rest of my talk is going to be focused on the other facilities and not Alma, although I'm very excited about Alma as well. So another thing I wanted to point out is that space telescopes are great, but they cannot spectrally resolve any of the lines that we're interested in. So I also added this line, here's Keplerian velocity at 1 AU around a solar mass star. And so you see that Spitzer and James Webb don't resolve those lines. And then if you ask, well, I'm interested in sub-Keplerian features, which instruments can do that? It's really only the highest resolution instruments that exist today. And those instruments also happen to be sensitive to sort of the 1 AU region of the disk. So that's what we're limited to if we want to study disk kinematics, or we can use ALMA, which would be further out. But we're a little bit blind to this sort of region of the disk. So I want to present just some of the observational evidence for this strange subclass of disks that we don't fully know how to explain, and then at the end I'll go into possible explanation, which is disk winds. So here's the basis of this conundrum that the observers noticed. If you look at CO fundamental emission lines, some of them are sort of more single peaked than you would expect. So here's what they look like. So here's, let's say, a normal protoplanetary disk. You get sort of a double peak. The double peak comes about from, these peaks are supposed to measure essentially the outer radius of your emission, and then the line wings measure the inner radius of your emission. And then there's a whole bunch of sources that just have a very centrally peaked line profile. And two possible ways to explain this away are low inclination, because what you actually see is the radial velocity, or a large spatial extent. So I'll explain why neither of those works. So first of all, one thing you could do is have low inclination. TW Hydra is a good example where you can actually fit the line profile just fine with a low inclination disk. Turns out that several of these sources, no matter what you do, no matter what inclination you use, you can't fit the line profile. So if you have a high inclination disk, you can fit the line wings, but you don't fit the central part. And the reverse is true. If you have a low inclination, then you fit the central part, but not the wings. And similarly, we have actual inclinations for some of these targets, and so we can actually just pin down what the inclination is, and we aren't able to fit the data with those inclinations. Another possible way to get rid of this conundrum is to say, well, let's have the emission extend extremely far out in the disk. Then you get a lot of emission at very small velocities. So that would bump up the middle part of your line profile. And this doesn't work because we actually have some spatial information about the emission. So this plot shows the second moment, essentially the width of the spatial profile of the spectrum. So what you would expect to see is if you had a disk and then right where the CO emission was, you had it extend to very large radii, then you would see a bump here. So it would show that right where the CO was, you had a large spatial extent. And that's not the case. So there's small spatial extent throughout the entire emission profile. There's another strange feature of these disks, which is that the spectro-astrometric profiles are asymmetric. And you cannot produce an asymmetric profile with just Keplerian motion. So here's what some of these look like. So you should see what I showed you in the other plot, going down, going up, and instead here you just see the down. Here you see it's down, but it's asymmetric, and here it's only up. So something is asymmetric about the velocity field.
So it's going toward you differently than it's going away from.
Right. Yeah. Okay, so that was the conundrum. And then I actually gave a talk about this, just sort of an informal talk a long time ago, where I tried to collect some of the other things that we might know about this subclass. So here's some of the things. So one thing I've been working on is water vapor emission. turns out that the water vapor line shapes look very similar to the CO line shapes. So whatever is happening seems to be happening to other molecules as well, not just CO. What's up?
I was making the jar, so it might be a black hole.
Another thing is that for these sources, the molecular line continuum ratios are really high. So this is just one snapshot of a very large survey that I did of molecular emission. This is CO emission. And if you look for all the sources that have just incredibly sharp, prominent emission lines, those are all of these targets. So you can see these popping out. In fact, they're bleeding into the ones above them. This has also meant that we have sort of had a bias towards studying these kinds of targets because they're easier to study, because they have really strong emission. I looked into whether this was also true in the mid-infrared, and I think that it's less clear in the mid-infrared. So if you look at, again, what we're looking at here is line-to-continuum ratios. These are Spitzer spectra. And you can kind of tell that the line-to-continuum ratio for these normal disks is not different from the centrally peaked line profile disks. So it's possible that this is somehow an inner disk phenomenon and doesn't extend to larger radii. Another feature that these disks have is that they have very high near-infrared veiling. So this is a plot showing two sources that have these peaked emission line profiles, the black and the red, at near 3 microns. What you're seeing is just continuum. But if you look at other sources, like this one, this is AA Tau, it has these very deep photospheric, stellar photospheric absorption features. So for these peaky line profile disks, we're seeing a lot of infilling of molecular lines from the star by some continuum. And again, this has led to some bias in the studying of protoplanetary disks. So this is the first announcement of ground-based water vapor emission measurements. And I was really excited when this came out. And then it's turned out to be really difficult to do additional observations of protoplanetary disks water, because what you see is stuff like this underlying the emission you're trying to see. So you see water vapor absorption in the star plus water vapor emission from the disk, and it becomes really hard to interpret, except for in these peaky line profile disks, where we get a beautiful continuum, and right above the continuum is our beautiful high line to continuum emission lines.
So by peaky, are you referring to the line?
Line profile.
The line, okay.
Yeah, having this very centrally peaked.
Right, instead of the double.
That's right. One of the problems with this is that it's an observationally motivated conundrum, right? So we had to come up with different names. So people sometimes call these the disk wind sources, and I wanted to avoid that because I'm not convinced yet that this is disk wind. So I'm trying to, I don't know. What's that? I'm trying to present from an observational perspective.
Are any of these transitional disks?
Sorry?
Are any of them transitional disks?
No, they're not.
Can you?
Yes.
Are there things there where, by similarity to these things, you would expect to see this if it was possible in a transition disk?
Would you expect it?
I guess the thing with a transition disk is all the emission comes from the outside, because that's the only place where there is a disk.
That's not true.
No.
No, that's not true.
No.
A large number of transition disks are accreting, and they do show, so TW Hydra, for example, that CO that you see is coming from.
A transition disk, which is not accreting. So it's just
only,
for the whole.
There's only a few of those, though. Yeah. Did that answer your question? Oh, you were saying, would you expect to see this from a transition disk? That's a good question. I mean, so if these are disk wind targets, my suspicion is that these are some sort of transition between class 1 and class 2. They're like, I think. This is kind of conjecture, and I'll get to it in a minute. But I feel like these are probably a little bit younger than the typical class 2, while the transition disks maybe are a bit older than the typical class 2. Maybe. But no, there's no overlap between those two categories. Oops. Failing is also high at optical wavelengths. This is something that I discovered when I sort of dug around to learn more about these targets. So back from 2008, this is optical spectra of three disks that have these unusual line profiles. And what you see is that sometimes they show these very strong absorption, photospheric absorption features, and sometimes they're gone. So they have high veiling and it's highly variable. This is probably the poorest plot in my talk, but I'll show it anyway. I also looked into, I just tried to figure out whether the FUV luminosities were high. And this was my best attempt at that. What I did was I took all of the luminosities from Yang et al. And I just plotted them in increasing order. And then I tried to identify whether I knew any of them were in fact these, oh, see here, I called it disk wind sources, whether any of these had the unusual line profiles, and whether I knew that they didn't have unusual line profiles. And it does seem like on average, they may have higher FUV luminosities as well. There's also at least some evidence that I think they could have just sort of an excess of infrared continuum emission, near-infrared continuum emission. So I was particularly working on this target and trying to fit its near-infrared emission with a disk model, and it turned out to be difficult to produce enough emission in near-infrared wavelengths with a passive disk model. There is sort of a debate, I would say, about whether accretion rates are actually higher for these targets or not. So in one of the first works on these types of targets was from Jeanette Bast, and here's what she said. The average accretion luminosity for these, what she called peaky sources, is half a solar luminosity. Half a solar luminosity, that sounds high. Anyway, this value is higher than the average accretion luminosity of 0.1 for the rest of the sample. And I looked into this a little bit further with a sample that I was working with, and I found that what she did not do correctly was account for stellar mass. So if you look at this sample and you look at that sample, they actually have different average masses. And so the more massive stars tend to have more accretion or higher accretion. And so when I looked at a sample of these targets, I actually wasn't able to find any difference in accretion luminosity versus between these targets and other targets. So I think that is less clear to me. Now, I did actually get to do ALMA observations of one source, and this is this AS205, which actually keeps popping up in a lot of these slides. So let me first show you, this is what you expect to see for a protoplanetary disk observed with ALMA. These are channel maps. So this here is the central velocity of, or maybe it's sort of in between these. Let's see, there are seven, so it should be this one. So that's what you would expect at the central velocity. And as you go towards the blue, you're seeing more of the blue side of the disk. And as you go towards the red, you see the red side of the disk. And this is the first moment map, so it shows the velocity field. So you're seeing the rotation like this.
And the cross is some background source, the reference source?
No, the cross is a secondary star. Yeah. So I think there is a cross here, which is where you expected this target to be. And I'll get to that in a minute. So it complicates things. Okay, so what do we see? It turns out to be very, very strange. So these are the observed channel maps. Actually, here you are seeing the secondary. So that is probably explaining that blob. But then you see just sort of extended emission that's curved. And when you look at the velocity field, it's also curved. So it's quite a strange observation. Here's a close-up of just the velocity fields compared to what you'd expect for a disk model. So this is 12CO. Here's the velocity field, this very strange curve. Here's what you would expect. And you even see it in the 13CO. Certainly some curvature in the velocity field compared to what you'd expect. Okay, so that's just the data. So let me tell you about a possible solution, which is the disk wind. I'm not going to explain disk winds in any detail because there are experts in this room. But to my basic understanding, we have magnetic field lines threading through the disk, and that can allow some charged particles to move along the field lines and leave the disk, and possibly entrain molecules along with them. And this has been proposed to be related to accretion processes, which would help our argument in any case. So what are the arguments for and against what we're seeing being related to disk wind phenomena? So argument four, a slow disk wind can produce peaky line profiles and asymmetric spectroastrometric curves. So how does it do this? Essentially, what it does is that for a given radius in the disk, the expected azimuthal velocities of the wind are slower than Keplerian. So it just produces more emission at lower velocities and helps infill that central part of the profile. The other thing is that you now have more emission coming towards you than away from you, so it breaks the symmetry of the spectroastrometric profile. And so Klaus Pontoppidan ran some models. So here's a disk only in blue, and then if he adds a parameterized disk wind, then he can fit both the emission line profile and the spectroastrometric profiles.
Sorry, what are those degree numbers?
These are, so when you do the spectroastrometry, you have to pick where to put your slit. So you put it at different position angles and you'll see different things. If you put it along the minor axis, you see nothing. If you see it along the major, put it along the major, you see the maximum deviation. And so to get a complete picture, you actually have to do multiple position angles.
So what is meant by a slow disk wind?
Good question. I'll get to that. Okay, that's in the cons.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, so I think another reason that this is kind of a promising avenue is that you might expect a disk wind to be correlated with accretion and in turn with inner disk heating. And so that could help explain why these sources have high veiling, because they just have very warm dust in the inner disk, or maybe even warm gas.
Ask a favor of you.
Yes.
Thank you.
Oh, can you not see the laser?
It blinds me.
Okay, got it. Okay, so you could, it could also help explain the high line to continuum ratios because you're just heating up your lines. Okay, so here are some of the cons. Basically, you have to really fine-tune your disk wind parameters to fit the data. And as far as I can tell, the parameters that are chosen are not physically motivated. They're just chosen to fit the data. And my understanding is that they may not even be consistent with current understanding of how disk winds work. So the model that Klaus Pontoppidan used in his analysis, and then I also tried to use for my ALMA data, is just based on this split monopole. And so many of you may be familiar with this, and it's completely defined by these geometric parameters. You can move this around, you can kind of move this around. It's really not a physically motivated model. And this comes back to what Jake was saying. One of the issues, I think, is that it may require unusually low velocities. So what kind of velocities do you need? Well, in the near-infrared, if you see this is the disk-only model, right, the blue, and here's the disk wind model. So that's the degree of shift that you're allowed to have. It's just a few kilometers per second. So any more than that, and it wouldn't be consistent with the data. So my understanding is that that's difficult to do with these models. And basically what Klaus Pontoppidan did was just tweak that parameter in the model, just set it to a very low number, and that was it.
When you're looking at the disk, are you seeing only one face that goes, that you're looking at? So the back?
Can't see the back.
No, cannot. Mm-mm. Even despite the lines are shifted by the Doppler effect, so you're only optically thick within the lines?
Yeah, in the infrared, they're still optically thick. And even if they weren't optically thick, the dust is optically thick. Another con, I think, is that it's not totally obvious to me how easy it would be for molecules to survive and or be formed in the wind. I understand that you can sometimes form CO in a wind if you have high enough densities. But if it turns out that water is undergoing whatever the same phenomenon is, water is a very tenuous molecule, easily photodissociated. So it seems difficult to me to retain water at a high abundance in a wind. When it comes to the ALMA data, I'm also not sure if this is a great explanation for what we're seeing. This is my channel maps for using a disk wind model that was similar to what Klaus Pontoppidan used. You do get some sort of warped velocity field, although it doesn't look like exactly what we see. If you make the velocities very low and you make the densities very high, you make the mass loss rate very high, then maybe you can get something kind of extended with an S-shaped velocity field, and I still don't think that fits our data very well.
Sorry, this rightmost row is the model.
So these are the data, and then the bottom three are models. This is a disk-only model, and these are two different models that include a wind, parameterized wind. So maybe you could say that this is a better fit to this than that, but I'm not so sure.
Why don't your models contain the binary?
So, do you mean like to try to fit this?
Yeah, I mean, I guess you're saying that you think it only comes in on that leftmost side, so maybe that's not
right.
The problem.
Yeah, but I'll. I mean, that's actually the next slide.
So, I mean, that's a very tiny area. There's no chance of any. There's not something just outside here that it could have had interacted with, which would have.
No, but it is. I think there is a question of what the binary interaction is doing.
Yeah.
Looking at the distance between the binary and the centroid and the rest of your maps, it's clear to me the binary is close enough to strongly interact with the disk.
Absolutely.
This looks rather like a tidal tail. You've got a 4.4.
Absolutely.
Yep. Wrong side at the moment.
Well, it's come round, of course. It's crushed into the disk on the other side.
Okay.
There you go, you see.
You're absolutely right. You're going to see in a couple slides.
So
again, I had to tune the parameters and in a non-physically motivated sense. And then as everybody's been mentioning, so this is a binary system. And I looked into this, so I worked with Diego Munoz on this paper. So here's one of his simulations where you do see these beautiful tidal tails. Here's our artist rendition for the press release. And my understanding is that, from talking to Diego, is you kind of have to have either a flyby, which is very unlikely, or you have to have a very eccentric system to have this tail be long-lived. So you are more expert on this than I am. And so it's my opinion that what we're seeing is some combination of the two effects. But I really don't know.
Wouldn't you expect it to be eccentric? And in the process of secularizing now with all this happening?
I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm a little confused by what you said Diego said, because those simulations that you're showing, right, that paper, the thing that you needed to be, you know, very close passage for or very eccentric for was to sort of change the orbit of the binary. But he didn't do any simulations that were binaries on close circular orbits, but you do generate tidal, you know, semi-long-lived titled tales.
Right. So what I remember him telling me was that if you had the kind of interaction that you need to create that strong tale, then you would, so there would be enough time for there to be multiple interactions, so you would tend to just clear out that area.
If you wait for many flybys, what you'll find is that the disk will be truncated to a size which is about 1/3 of the pericentral separation between the two planets, eventually.
Yeah.
If this is the first flyby that ever happens, then there's very asymmetric structure.
Right, and so the first flyby scenario is unlikely for this impact parameter. And this basically not very dense star forming region. Yeah. So, I don't know. I don't know the answer. And I think it's some combination of the two, but I really don't know. So, where are we going from here? So, the main thing I would love to do is get more ALMA data, basically of binary systems and non-binary systems, and see which of these features remain and which don't. I have not had luck with the ALMA TAC, so wish me luck in the future. I think it's because this is such an unusual thing, and there aren't a lot of people studying it, so there's just not like enough buzz about this topic. The thing I'm going to be working on for my sabbatical is the water emission, to see whether it's really following whatever the same phenomenon is as the CO. But really, one of the reasons I'm here is that many of the people in this field are hoping that modelers take notice of what we're seeing and help us explain it. So again, this is not all protoplanetary disks, but it's an awful lot of them. And we really don't understand what's happening, but it's real. It's there, it's in the data. And these are going to be some of the easier disks to observe. And so we're going to be getting a lot of observations of these disks because they're bright. And they have these very strong emission lines, and we're seeing molecules, so they're going to be well-studied disks well into the future, and so we'd really like to know what's going on. So that's it, and I really look forward to talking to you all about this.
Just following up on this, do you know whether or not any of these others are binaries? Your peaky things, are they typically in binaries?
No, they're not.
Okay.
I mean, some of them are and some of them aren't. Yeah. It's just I have no idea whether those ALMA features that we see are limited to binaries or not, because that's the only, as far as I know, that's the only source of this type that's been observed with ALMA so far. No, did you have a question?
Could you say anything? Say something about what Sophia can potentially do. So there's something similar to TEXIs that's flying on Sophia?
Yeah, so Sophia is a small telescope, so it turns out to be a little bit challenging to do these observations with Sophia.
Does that mean not really worth considering, or?
Yeah, you can study her big AABE disks with Sophia, and as you saw maybe in one of my earlier slides, they're not molecule rich. So it turns out they're bright enough to observe with Sophia, but they don't have molecular emission.
Yes, it's funny, there are catechumen variables called SW-sextanti that also have a single peak emission lines, but it is known that they have a rather high inclination, but as far as I remember, the model combines sounds that you won't have in general, stream overflow plus wind. So maybe you could find inspiration in that, even if you don't have something like, you don't have a stream, of course, because you don't have in general a binary, but it's been a puzzle for many years. And it's a pity that Christian, he's busy with something. Christian Krieger, he knows everything about that. But there is something, in a sense, similar, even if probably the physics, the scheme, the general scheme is different, but there might be common
Yeah, maybe.
Common features.
Yeah, I'd love to read some references about that.
Yeah, you're right. The only thing I could possibly think of is that in this interact, you showed the lovely simulation with the tails and everything, that you get some effect which gives you the equivalent of a mass transfer string.
Right, except, you know, not all of these sources are binary.
How essential is the stream in those, in the interpretation of those observations? Because if you just have the wind, you're basically looking at exactly the same thing that she's presented here. Anyway, Christian will be back, hopefully. I mean, we will make sure he comes back. Right now, he's preparing HST observations because the work never went out into outburst, and he's trying to get the director's discretionary time. That's where he is, but I shouldn't have said that while this is being recorded, anyway.
I just wonder about this business about the wind speed, because, of course, we are somewhat conditioned to think that the winds must be escaping from the system. I wonder whether or not there is a room for a model where the wind launching is so inefficient that it actually just falls back on the disk at some point, and that what you see is indeed a slow wind, and what you're seeing here is emission from the wind just as it's leaving the disk surface before you have any dissociation of molecules or anything like that. I mean, there's no fundamental principle that saying the wind has to escape the system, right? It could in principle come out and fall back again.
It could have an eddy.
Yeah, or kind of like a fountain that comes back. So it's not so much.
That's a magnetically driven wind?
Well, it could be magnetic, because again, you know, depending on how you set up the field strength, it may not quite get out all the way.
Well, no, so I'm wondering, could you diminish the importance of the role of magnetic field?
Yes, you could by just dialing down the field strength.
And just do it because we already.
It becomes like a floppy wind rather than one of these beautiful plant and pain things which go all the way. So, I mean, you know, it'd be interesting to explore that a little bit, I think, and say, well, you know, we have these images rather like you have of, you know, field lines coming out straight and things, you know, going along there, reaching, you know, speeds in excess of the alpha and velocity and the rest of it, getting launched out of the system. But that may not be how it works. I mean, maybe things are actually much messier than that, and the stuff comes out and then falls back again. And maybe it has some intermittency associated with it in such a way that actually a few kilometers per second is exactly what happens, not.
Do you model these lines
from winds?
Not
from winds,
yeah.
That's what we're working on.
Oh, you're
yeah.
Just turbulence.
Yes.
Okay, sorry, Kate.
So I also, this is very high, but if I ignore the, you know, launching and eventual acceleration to alpha and speed, if I just want it to escape the system, all I need is a factor, an enhancement of root 2, right? I mean, why should I naively expect escape velocity to be fast? It should be small, right? Before it gets accelerated.
No, but what is fast here? What is slow and what is fast here? How slow do you need it to be? That's what you're asking, basically, is that right?
Okay. I'm saying, is a factor of square root of 2 ruled out?
Yes.
Okay, so what are you starting with?
Keplerian.
Take the Keplerian velocity, multiply by root 2.
30 kilometers a second times 1.4.
Right. I mean,
I thought you were saying it changed a few kilometers a second.
This is line of sight velocity. Is that how we should interpret this? Literally line of sight velocity.
Yes.
No tilting or anything like that. It's just what you see through the telescope.
Yes, but I mean your disk may be tilted.
No, indeed. But you've done nothing to the data, so
this is the data.
So could, in principle, the wind velocity be a lot higher and you're just looking at the line of sight?
Well, but some wind velocity goes into the model, so we're curious, what sort of wind velocity do you need to put in order to get this, you know, pretty impressive agreement with the data?
Yeah, so I don't remember exactly, like, what the parameters are that go in, but you can see that there's virtually no shift of this emission line profile from a disk model.
But that doesn't mean that. But I guess what I'm saying is there's a difference between saying it's slow, i.e. the wind is a few kilometers per second, and it's slow, i.e. it's only a small shift from Keplerian, which is exactly what escape velocity is.
think the wind has to be slow because you have to fill in, so you're not just...
Okay.
You're filling in zero.
You're filling in zero. But then I don't see how a fallback model helps you, because a fallback model would also be accelerated. I don't see how any velocity has anything to do with gravity. It's not.
You just need a wind that's hovering there enough.
It's hovering. Right, exactly.
That sounds like some disc corona.
All right.
But
or even turbulence. Why does, I mean, the turbulence speeds are much less than the Copernican speed.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can't you just play games with that?
Well, yeah, right, if you had a whole bunch of turbulence, Jake, could you fill it in?
Yeah,
in principle, yeah.
Yeah, I think that could help with the line profile. It would not help with the spectroastrometric asymmetry.
Turbulence, zero. I mean, the thing is, if your peak emission is coming from 180, let's just say that's where it comes from, then you'd need a permanent line width of 30 kilometers a second to fill into zero.
That's true.
It's tiny.
Yeah, it would widen every part of that curve. It wouldn't push everything to the middle.
So you have emission which is at the same systemic velocity as a star.
Yeah, so that's why you need to add slow velocity emission on top.
So why isn't the explanation that this is embedded? Or there's some, right, you have some non-Keplerian rotating stuff.
Oh, I mean, so first of all, this is really hot gas that we're talking about for the CO fundamental. And then there just is no known envelope for these targets.
So temperature's a few thousand Kelvin.
Mm-hmm. Few thousand.
Well, the excitation temperatures are a few thousand. So, but it's thought that it comes from the inner part of the disk, so maybe it's 1500 Kelvin or something like that.
That's well within 180 then. The disk isn't 1,500 Kelvin at 1 AU.
Yeah, that's right.
It's like a couple few
hundred
Kelvin. That's the dust sublimation. That's like 0.1 AU, right?
Yeah, so the winds are consistent with dust sublimation radius, and then, you know, it extends out to some extent, but exactly how much is not clear.
If I were to play around with the concentrations of molecules or density in the disk, you know, density profile radially, would I be able to bring up, absent the disk wind, the emission at zero velocity? I mean, what controls the amplitude of the line?
Well, it would be the temperature, because essentially it's optically thick gas, so you can't really mess with the density profile that much. So I think
if
it would
were to heat up the disk at larger radii, would I bring up the zero velocity point?
That's a good question. To some extent, I guess, but you would have to make sure it didn't extend far enough that it looked spatially extended.
Oh, okay.
You have some limits on that.
This is...
Yeah, if you had like a reverse temperature profile.
Yeah, but I mean, maybe there is some, like, the stream is plunging from the outside, just hitting the disk, who knows.
Yeah, that's interesting.
What do these other diagrams tell us about where you've taken the slip and moved it around? I mean, is there information there, or spatial distribution, or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, so this was Klaus's best attempt to fit that with a model. So you see the red is a model with a disk wind, and then the blue is just a disk, and then here's the data. So you can kind of get these asymmetric profiles. Yeah.
Like a wind is a kilometer per second wind coming from 1 AU is not a wind, right?
Yeah,
that's just the physics is wrong, right? I don't see how that can be. Yes, your point was right. You can obviously turn the knobs on the model, but there's gravity and stuff.
That's her con. I mean, she said
that's the con. Right, but it's such a slow. It's just like
yes. And so I think that's where we are right now, right? Where the theorists are saying this is crazy, and then the observers are saying, well, it's something that we're seeing, it's real, so what is it? And I think we're all a little bit stuck.
There's no proposals that have anything to do with the star? Some stuff.
The star.
Mm-hmm. What is the effect of temperature of the star in these systems?
I think that they're... solar to slightly more massive than solar.
So very high, much higher than the temperatures that you're improving here.
Yeah.
This freak reactor that controls the angle between the magnetic, oh sorry, the outflow lines and the midplane.
Yeah.
How does that affect the shape of the spectrum?
Let's see. So yeah. So like, as you move this around, then you get kind of more like this versus this. So I guess the more parallel it is to the disk, the lower the velocities you would see if you're close to face on. Yeah.
Can that be way too exposed?
Well, I think that was maybe part of it. So he did choose that parameter. And so that was probably part of it. So that's a good question. What is that factor? I don't know offhand. So how much did that reduce the actual velocity down to what was needed for the
atmosphere? Because one thing that's different with this model than what my black hole simulations show is that usually the disk is self-similar. If the scale height is independent of radius, then all the outflow lines make the same angle with the midplane, as opposed to the wind shooting up straight near the central source and being almost horizontal at large radii, as this wind locus model would imply. So if you actually were to fix the angle, the inclination angle of all these streamlines, then there would be, and you would kind of compress them to be almost parallel to the midplane, then the component of velocity of this outflow towards the observer would be very much diminished by h over r, let's say. Factor of h over r.
Right.
If h over r is much less than 1, maybe that could help.
Yeah, that's interesting. So it would be good. I should probably go and look at what are the inclinations of all these disks. Because if they're all close to face on, then that would work. But if some of them are higher inclination, it would stop working. Yeah, that's interesting.
I guess the other thing is that when some of the simulations we've run, I don't know if any of those are actually in the Gressel et al. Paper. Sometimes the parts of the wind will flip and actually point inwards towards the axis instead of it. You can also get the angular momentum to work out that way. Since the observations aren't spatially resolving that much, if I just took all those field lines and flipped them to the other side of the disk, would everything look the same in the model?
Well, so these are not field lines, right?
Make
these
them point
are wind.
Inwards. Make the wind, the wide angle wind point inwards, not outwards. I think it's
point
zero.
Like that? So it's going. So it's sucking onto the disk.
So like this. It'll
come out this way.
Yeah.
Well, that is happening as well. We just don't.
No. So on the same side.
I think what Colin means is instead of having the winds do this, collect. Go like that. Instead.
Oh, they're doing that.
They come back in.
Yeah.
Like the dash lines. Point towards the rotation axis rather than away from it.
It'd be like the dash lines.
Yeah. Looks pretty much the same.
I would think so.
The line of sight is kind of the same.
It's
very
interesting.
Are we seeing, just a second, we're speaking about the stuff that's only within a fraction of an AU from the start of this whole discussion? Are we talking about the 10 AU?
Are we talking about what?
The 10 AU material emitting this stuff, or only the stuff that's...
So this is probably very close to the star, the CO fundamental, and then the OM observations are farther from the star.
It's all messed up.
But whether that's related to this, is I think that's not clear.
Yeah.
Actually, I do like your idea of reversing, because I think I think if you actually knew the sense of rotation of the disk, then your spectroastrometric profile might be reversed in the two cases. I have to think about that.
That structure you've got there is simply a replication of the of Christian's basic CV wind, and it's doing that because of the physics underlying it, which certainly are not occurring here. So you could, what Richard suggested, could easily be the case for you.
I'll have to think about that a little.
That was very stimulating. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening.